The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're now listening to Greg. It's the Brothers Wisp. Let's take a ride.
Hey, everybody. This is Greg with the Brothers Wisp number 105. Today we have Thomas Kiernek from Slovakia.
Hello, everyone.
Oh, just one hello. Usually it's hello, hello. Oh, man. Must not be feeling yourself.
It was a hard week.
Oh, that's too bad. Also with us, we have T-Cent. We got Tommy C over here. What's up, Tommy?
Thanks, Greg, for having me. Getting back from going to visit some family, so.
Excellent.
Really good.
You're in Colorado, right?
Yep.
All right. Keeping it cool with all of you legalized pot smokers over there.
Can't trust you guys. It's fully legal. You can get higher concentration of THC pot in Colorado than you can in Amsterdam. That's at least what I'm told.
Didn't they just recently legalize magic mushrooms there as well?
No, I don't think that passed.
Oh.
I don't think, at least it wasn't us, yeah.
I knew they were taking a swing at it. All right. Well, let's get the busy work out of the way. Thank you to all the new patrons. We got Matthew Miller, we've got Stephen Lamb, and we've got Alan Scott. Look at that, all names I could pronounce, and I mean maybe I messed one of those up, but perhaps I got them all correct. And when we say patron, those are guys that support the podcast. You go to patreon.com/thebrotherswisp, throw us a couple bones, you get access to our patron-only Slack. And to be honest with you, that's what I build most of these show notes from. That's where a lot of my conversation happens. It used to be, you know, we did a lot more on Facebook, and I know Mike still does a lot of stuff on Facebook, but man, I just don't have the heart to do it anymore. It's so much faster. I love the back and forth discourse on Slack. It's so much quicker. And then get access to a lot of people with no trolls. Well, I guess Mike's still a troll. You know, love him or hate him, he's still going to be a troll. Let's see, what else do we have? We have Sonar is sponsoring this podcast as well. Sonar is your scalable, intuitive, comprehensive ISP billing and operational support system. So go check those guys out over at sonar.software. Thank you again, Sonar. Let's see, a little bit of front matter, some stuff that's catch up from the last podcast. We were speculating over the chipsets in the CRS300 something, something, something. It was the 48-port switch that's coming out, because they had mentioned they had a MIPS BE CPU on it, and I'm told that all the CRS300 series have the same switching ASICs. They just threw in a MIPS BE to run RouterOS to give you access to all the good configuration stuff, but it still has all the same hardware capabilities that the other 300s have. So rest assured, the new one will still perform like the other ones. What else did I hear? Another little bit of scuttlebutt I heard was that all of the equipment announced at the MUM EU 2019, they're hoping to have released around the MUM EU 2020 time. And they said, worst case, the China virus, it might be MUM US 2020. So look out for equipment coming out fairly soon. Another interesting thing I got from a kid that I know over there at Microtik is he was saying that the Mexican MUM, April 22nd to the 24th, they're doing a train the trainers class there. They said they are offering it in Spanish, but enough people, and it's in Cancun, Mexico, which is a pretty baller place. I've been there a couple times. They said if enough people sign up for English language version, then this person would get to stay longer at the MUM, so they are hoping that it makes. So if you guys are interested in doing train the trainers in a tropical setting, jump over there. They said signups are by, give me just a second to make sure, it says by February 14th, Valentine's Day, English spoken class. If you want it, go to microtik.com/training/train-the-trainer and sign up for that. All right. All that stuff's out of the way. We're good. Let's see. What else do we have? So speaking of the U.S. MUM, that's coming up pretty soon, and they approved the Brothers Wisp panel again. This time we're getting an hour. And for all of you guys that haven't been to one of those, I would encourage you to come with all of your random questions. They make us pick a topic. So we always say routing best practices, but it's really ask anything. And you've got a diverse group of people that will answer the questions. So I know.
Don't give away our secrets, Greg. Now that won't work anymore.
Well, you know what's so funny? You know what's so funny is the first couple, I had a whole bunch of questions prepped because I was sure that we were just going to get crickets and nobody was going to say anything. And then we immediately got deluged. And then the last one we did, of course, I didn't prep anything because we had had such good success. And then obviously it was crickets chirping right off the bat. But once it seems like once the ball gets rolling, everybody starts talking and asking questions. So I'm going to prep a small handful of questions to get going there. But I think it's really cool. I almost wonder why Microtik doesn't do it themselves, just with their own people, you know, just standing up there and have everybody firing questions at them. Seems like it would be a good thing. I mean, you could be a mixture of Microtik folks and enthusiasts as well up there on the panel. But I really love the idea of kind of roundtable discussion scenarios. And it seems like in the past, we've always, even when, you know, we ran out of time, we still had hands going up, right? So it's, it's, I think it's, to me, that says it's useful, right? People actually are getting value out of it. And so I enjoy doing it. It's a lot less work than putting together slide decks and all that stuff. I signed up for another presentation of my own. They haven't approved it yet, funny enough. Maybe it's because it's just me. But the panel, they approved immediately, which is great. You're going to be at this one, right, Thomas?
That's the plan.
That's the plan. All right. So it'll be me and Thomas for sure. I don't know who else is going to show up this year.
I'm debating it.
This one's
in Kansas.
Kansas City, Kansas. You know, what's funny is I assume those places were very far apart, and I looked it up, driving directions. It's like from town center to town center. It's like 8 minutes. So
they're right across the river.
They're quite literally the same city. They just have a border dividing the two. So it's interesting. There's a place in Kansas City, Missouri called the Chicken and Pickle. It's this big pickleball place where you can get fried chicken. So I'm thinking I'm going to get there a day early and go check it out. I always enjoy that. What is that? It's April, right? Isn't that when the thing is?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
11?
Yeah, mid-April. Somewhere around in there.
Yeah.
When Thomas comes over to the U.S., that's when it is.
Oh, but I think it's a little bit of a mess because it's the Visp America, then it's Mom EU, and then it's Mom US immediately. Like, all of them are about a week apart, so it's going to be busy.
Oh, yeah. Man.
April 15th to the 16th is the Mom.
You're going to be living on a plane. Are you going to be? Are you going to bring your new sales guy with you, Thomas?
I don't know yet. Maybe. Maybe.
Keep you company. Yeah, I had the pleasure of talking to him the other day. He's a really nice guy. He says he speaks a whole bunch of languages too, right?
Yeah, a bunch.
That's cool.
He worked all over the place basically before us, like in different, basically pretty much all around Europe and related regions. And so yeah,
that's cool. That sounds like a definite asset. And if his other languages are as sharp as his English, man, that guy's, he's on point. He's gonna have a lot of fun going to the various mums. What's your presentation going to be on this year?
So IPsec, and simply because I've been doing presentations on IPsec for a long time now, right? And I get about an email a month of people asking, you know, can you give me updated configurations on IPsec? Because Microtik basically completely reworked how IPsec is configured recently, right? So all of my previous presentations, basically the theory and how things works and the protocol details are still correct, but the code snippets on how to configure it, this is not correct anymore. So the plan is to have one presentation that this time doesn't talk about IPsec theory anymore, like all the other presentations cover that pretty well. It's just about, you know, how do you do these most used scenarios in IPsec on Microtik with up-to-date configurations.
That's
so
cool.
It's pretty much, I'm just doing a presentation to get rid of all the emails that are coming in. And, you know, how do I do this now after all the changes?
Self-serving. Well, you got to do one. You might as well make it to your maximum benefit, right?
Yeah. So now when I receive an email, just here's a PDF.
Yeah. I've recently been trying to force feed myself, like fire hose, as much DevOps as I can. So I've been really focusing a lot of my attention and energy on Ansible. So I thought, you know, what better way than to give myself a ticking time bomb? So I signed up to do an Ansible presentation. And I looked, and there has been one before in the past, but it looked like they really just talked about what Ansible was and didn't really show it in operation or have any scripts associated with actually configuring it on anything really on MikroTik. So I'm just going to say, hey, for the theory of Ansible, that's this over here. If you want to get up and going in 5 minutes, here's this. This is, we're going to show you how to get going really super fast and just talk about the basics, what you absolutely need to know, and then here's some example scripts that you can kind of work off of doing various things. So,
you know, my reply to that is, if you want to get started in 1 minute, there's always Unimus.
yeah. Unimus is, yeah, I mean, true story. Don't think I'm not going to mention Unimus in there, obviously, because I will, because Thomas is my robot overlord. He's, you know, half human, half machine, and so I'm just preparing for the day that he takes over the world. Anyway, I will mention that, and Unimus does have some amazing features where it can go out and make mass configuration pushes, but right, Ansible is, I guess, pulled back. It's more kind of orchestration across server, network, really anything that you can SSH into, theoretically, you can do some management there with that. So it's,
it's a different use case.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But since this is networking, I'm going to focus more on networking, even though with the understanding that this does extend over to the server world and, you know, other manufacturers' equipment to do various, I don't know, there's no sense in getting into it now, because I'll do that in the presentation, right? So there you go. But yeah, I just thought it would be interesting to see a bunch of use cases that I could think of just whatever I can concoct. And I'm actually curious to see if people have some common use cases or some problems they'd like to solve in mass configuration with automation. Obviously, you could do it with Unimus, but I need some material. I need some fodder for my presentation. So I'm trying to get as many as I can ahead of time. And then honestly, it's a lot of, I haven't had fun doing like networking challenges for a long time, and this is a lot of fun because it's, hey, upgrade the version in mass on all these things, and then, you know, okay, check and make sure their version matches this. If it doesn't, then do it, you know. And so it's just, I'm actually getting to kind of flex my mental muscles here again. And so anybody that can come up with any scenarios, I would love to have them fire those over to me so that I can put them into the presentation, just to have some example scripts.
Might have some stuff for you. I've got, we're doing some active Ethernet fiber customers. Nice. And we're doing, I just went ham on the system, and it's like a VLAN to each customer and all sorts of silliness that keeps the customer from having, like if they plug in just a switch into my, OLT or ONT, whatever, optical network terminal, it's basically a MikroTik PowerBox Pro, and is how I'm splitting out. So if they plug a switch in, they get a DHCP server. My switch, the PowerBox, works as a router. If they plug in a router and plug in their IP settings, they just spit right on through, and I don't have to touch anything. So it's kind of a lot of config work. And I wrote my own program for just generating all of these, the possible configs for all my possible customers. You know, there's only 4,095 that you can use. So, but would the Ansible be good at that? Like, hey, I just plug this thing in, and I can just say, tell Ansible to scan the network, and whenever something pops in at this point, upload and go.
So what I've been doing with Ansible is, I'm not sure if you can extend it to do automatic scanning and then adding stuff in, but generally, what I've seen so far is you have kind of like an inventory file that you just fill out. And so as you're adding devices in there, I mean, you could theoretically add every device that could exist, but you can just continually add devices as they come online in there, you know, so you give them kind of a name and then you tell it what its IP address is, or you can go by DNS name. And then when you have the scripts, you can either have them scheduled to run, or you can just fire them off manually, or you can use AWX, which is the open source version of Tower, which is their GUI, that you can log their web GUI, you can log in and then fire it off on that host, and it will, yeah, it can connect in and configure it however you want. You can give it roles is what they call it. So you could say, like, here's a role that's like my base firewall, and here's a role that's you know, it's going to be one of these transport switches. And so for like the role that's base switch, you know, in there you'll say, okay, well, here's all the firewall rules, here's all of the administration stuff, here's the syslogging, you know, all the common stuff, and it'll just reach out and it'll make those configuration changes. And then since you've also assigned it, hey, this is a transport switch, it'll also reach out any of the things you've said, hey, this is special for transport, it'll reach out and make those changes as well. So it's really good for like base config stuff. So they have this concept of source of truth, where you can have like a master configuration file for a device on the server, and it will always make sure the configuration looks like this. That works really well when they have modules constructed for like Cisco stuff. So I've tried it with some Cisco stuff, and then you could do it with like Juniper or various things, especially in the server world. It's very good for that. But MikroTik doesn't have a lot of modules, right? So it's more like MikroTik can push changes to a device and it can read stuff back, but it can't like say, hey, here's all the changes they want me to make. Because this is what the source of truth modules really do, like the idempotent ones, is they'll say, hey, it needs these three VLANs, and it'll check and see, are these VLANs in existence? If they are, it won't make any changes. You know, so it's really good about that kind of thing. Whereas in the MikroTik stuff, it doesn't have a module that's intelligent enough to say, hey, does it have these VLANs configured? Because it doesn't really... Nobody sat down and wrote the module to be able to do that little piece. Anybody is free to, but nobody's really gone that far down the rabbit hole. And there's some stuff I want to do that doesn't exist. Well,
the thing is, there's multiple ways to even just look at set up VLANs.
Yeah.
In MikroTik.
And it's funny too, like whenever you're making the idempotent stuff, you know, like in Cisco, you can say if you want to go into an interface, you just say interface FA01 for fast Ethernet. But if you want it to be idempotent, you've got to use the whole fast Ethernet 0/1. You've got to use the whole thing. Because when it runs it, the thing that's going to come back is going to say fast Ethernet 0/1. And if you use the, you know, a truncated version of that, it's like, oh, these two are different. So then it'll try and like update it. Right. So it's very particular about how you do that kind of like special source of truth stuff. Man, I'm learning so much so fast.
Does it have a way to, so like all my customers are going to be very regular in how they're going to be set up. They each get a /30 to them. They like, and each VLAN is going to be one right after the other. Is there a way to say like, here is the spot where I want you to inject this VLAN number throughout the whole file? No, here, 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 and here. And then same for IP address. And then for the next piece of equipment, here's where I can do all that. And, or is that more like Thomas's
thing? I saw some people building config files with it. So it would do all those role things, but it would ultimately build one big like RSC file that you could use and apply. Or
so probably what, Tommy, what you are talking about is more a provisioning system, which is something else, which actually, if you want to check, as Greg is talking about the single source of truth concept, there is a thing called the CMDB, a configuration management database. And if you want to check, I think it was like 5 or 6 years ago, I had a presentation on MikroTik provisioning specifically from a CMDB. It was about automating some 1500 routers provisioning. And that discusses a lot of what Greg is saying, and specifically challenges on MikroTik with provisioning configurations. And since MikroTik doesn't have a transactional approach to basically submitting any configuration, arbitrary configuration data, you know, you don't have, like on a Juniper, you don't have, you know, commits and an individual basically transactional approach like you have on Cisco and everywhere else. With MikroTik, the only real way to assure that everything is configured in a state that you want it to be is to actually reload the entire configuration. So you have to actually you know, upload a script to a device and say system reset configuration, no defaults, run after and run a specific script.
Right.
And this is because on a MikroTik, you know, with a single command, MikroTik has a dynamic scripting language built in. So you can do for loops, you can do conditionals and everything else. So with a single line, or rather with three lines of script in MikroTik, you can generate 1,000 VLANs, right? And there is no basically itemization, and there is no transactional approach to the configuration on RouterOS. And this is why, like Greg was saying, independency on RouterOS is extremely hard. Due to just the sheer power of the RouterOS scripting language. And basically there is more details discussed in that presentation. I don't want to repeat all that.
Yeah.
But just MikroTik is very particular about how you have to do things as well if you want them to be, you know, assured a certain state. But definitely checking out CMDBs is a really nice thing because, in Ansible you have basically facts and you have roles and stuff like that, and you can build out a bunch of stuff and construct a file from role-based files and stuff like that. But usually if you want to go more, I would say more professional, a CMDB is usually used. And even Ansible can actually feed its own facts and its own variables into the Jinja templates and stuff like that can be fed from a CMDB. And so usually you use CMDB for basically the fact storage, a single source of truth, and then you pull stuff out of there.
Yeah. You know, more and more I get into Ansible, the more it feels like glue. It feels like super glue. Because it's Southbound interface. It can connect to a lot of different diverse pieces of equipment, right? So it can go to a router. It can go to a switch. It can go to a firewall. It can go to a server. It can also connect to... something like Cisco's DNA Center, you know, their SDA controller, right? So it can connect to Cisco's SDA and say, hey, provision these VXLAN tunnels across this infrastructure that you're managing, and it'll do all that stuff. But it's also got a northbound interface, so it's got its own API that you can then have your piece of software, like Thomas said, a CMDB, and it can push to, or rather it can make calls to Ansible and then have him kind of orchestrate over to all these various things. So it really feels like, you know, some crazy glue that you can kind of connect all these things together with.
Yeah, Ansible is basically a framework. It's a set of tools that give you the power to do anything if you have the time. It's basically for example, for servers, for configuration management, we use Puppet, which is just about the same, right? It's just a set of tools that by out of the box literally does nothing, right? You have to write the manifests, you have to write the modules, etc., etc. It's the same with Ansible. It only makes what you make it do, and it gives you the tools and the power to automate, you know, basically whatever you want and how you want it.
Yeah. So what was it? Puppet pulls, right? So it usually has a client that pulls, but they work around that with like older switches and routers where you can't put a client on them by having a proxy, where the proxy will actually pull and then do the push over to the end devices, right?
So Puppet has both an active and a passive mode, so agent and agentless. So basically Puppet can do just about anything Ansible can do. The difference there is that Ansible has a lot of modules already built for networking equipment, whereas Puppet doesn't have as many. Simply because Puppet prefers running agents. Like Juniper has a native Puppet agent on Junos, which you can deploy, and then basically Junos is, you know, natively integrated into Puppet. Cisco as well on their Linux platforms, but only on the Linux platforms. And basically for anything else, for the passive, you know, non-agent mode, you have to write and script those modules yourself, just like in Ansible, except in Ansible, somebody most likely has already done the work for you.
Yeah. You know, I was looking at a lot of their iOS and Juniper modules and various things like that, and it seems like the manufacturers actually maintain those modules. So they're the guys actually making commits to that. So it's not necessarily the Ansible team supporting those modules. It's the actual manufacturer who's pushing out those updates. So they actually, which is interesting, is they have dedicated programmers making modules just for Ansible. I mean, maybe they also, you know, kind of work with Puppet and things like that, but I thought that was pretty cool, right? The manufacturer, they're going to make a change so then they can know ahead of time what that stuff's going to be and then have that pushed out and ready for the new modules. Whereas, you know, if the Ansible team's doing it, they're always going to be playing catch up, trying to see what's the new stuff, and then let's hurry up and try and integrate as quick as possible. I guess it probably means that Ansible team doesn't have to employ as many programmers too, so that's probably good for them as well. Offload some of the work.
Pretty much all of the configuration management tools, be that Chef, Puppet, Ansible, SaltStack, or really any of them, which those four are the major ones, you know, they always rely on the community or on external sources to provide the modules or the manifests. They provide, like I mentioned, the framework, the tool, right? But it's up to the community or up to external entities or vendors to basically adopt their equipment or adopt their software or their solutions into the framework, into the configuration management system. It's the same, for example, with Puppet. You know, NGINX module in Puppet is actually also written by NGINX, well, now F5, since F5 bought NGINX a half year ago or so. But yeah, like Apache module in Puppet is also written by Apache, right, and etc. So it's the same concept. Like all of those, the major four configuration management tools are very similar in what they do on the concept level. They are just very different on how they do it in the implementation level. For example, you know, Ansible is all about YAML and Jinja and stuff like that, whereas Puppet has a custom Ruby-based DSL, domain-specific language, whereas Chef is also different, whereas SaltStack is also different, right? So the implementation and the details are different, but like in their principle, it's the same framework that allows you to control configuration of things.
Gotcha. Didn't some of this stuff, like, didn't Ansible fork from Puppet or Chef or something like that and then develop that way?
No, it's all separate things with their own histories and their own differences.
Uh-huh. I thought, like, the developers of Ansible, like, used to work on one of those projects and then kind of split off. They didn't like the direction it was going. So that's, I might have just made all of that up on the spot, but it seems like
it's also possible. I don't actually know the I haven't heard that particular thing, but it's entirely possible. Yeah, it's, you know, wouldn't be the first time that has happened.
Yeah,
in the software,
right?
Industry.
Like, I don't like the way this is going. I don't like the way you guys are doing this. I could do it better. Oh man, let's pivot. Zach was asking the other day, he was saying that they had some snafu at one of their sites, and he was asking how long, or how can you tell in a Cisco router how long a BGP route has been cached? And I know in the iOS XR stuff, you can just do show BGP and then the subnet, and it will actually, I can't remember off the top of my head, it's like the fourth line down, it'll actually tell you how long it's been cached for that particular route. I checked on some of my just regular iOS stuff, like on my cat, 65, 7600 series stuff, and I couldn't really find out. And then in MikroTik, I was looking at that as well, and I couldn't see how long they were cached in there. I don't know about Juniper stuff. I didn't have any access to Juno's kit, but I'm assuming some of their bigger stuff probably tells you how long those have been cached in there for. So, I don't know. I found that to be somewhat interesting. Also, somebody was encouraging me to fix my BGP lab, because I had let that kind of get bricked a little bit, so I fix it again. And that is a CCR going to an ASR 9000, and I pulled 780,000 routes in about 20 seconds, which I found to be pretty impressive. That ASR 9000 is bored, though, so it had plenty of resources available to fire hose those routes at the CCR, and the CCR wasn't doing anything else, so that's a pretty good load. I was surprised. I didn't expect them to pull that fast, but it is, and so those routes are there and available for you to connect. My second router is down at the moment. Not enough people have complained, so I haven't fixed it. So if people complain more, I'll get that one up too. And that one actually, the second one pulls off of a completely set of a different set of upstream providers. So it gives you a better view of the internet, I guess. So you get 780 from one and about 780 from the other. So it's a pretty good way to kill a router really fast. I know that. If you're not ready for it.
Well, I just say thank you. I really appreciated being able to take down my routers a couple times from your full feed. It taught me, like, oh, this is how you kill a 1036 with a bunch of BGP feeds. So,
yeah. Or you just, you're in the Winbox and you say, like, resend or something, and then your Winbox just locks up and then goes away. And you're like, oh,
yep.
That's what happens.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, it made my us transitioning to BGP a little bit less heartrending. Like it was, still was. It wasn't not bad, but at least I knew some things to expect and what it should look like when I wasn't screwing up.
Remember when I first started working in a real ISP environment? That was the thing that scared me the most, was BGP. I mean, obviously I had the least amount of experience with it, but I don't know. It just felt like this. It felt like I was trying to steer the Titanic, you know. It's such a massive process and there's so many knobs. I mean, there are so many knobs and I didn't fully understand how all of it worked. So it was pretty terrifying for me back then. Yeah. I know that for sure.
Yeah. I can't say that I know what I'm doing exactly, but I'm peering and nobody's complaining about me doing wrong things. So as far as I can tell, everything is working as I intended.
Yeah.
So
as long as you're not hijacking other people's IP space, you're fine.
Actually, so actually
you mentioned it.
For my BGP stuff, I didn't screw up. But my upstream, he took out half of Northeastern Colorado's internet because I was announcing IPs that are a /24 of that they were selling me, and he had been aggregating that up until that point and announcing it out, and so he didn't take my /24 out, and so for whatever reason his what are they running, the Fujitsu or whatever stuff, just threw this huge fit about that happening, and the internet went down for everybody else besides me. And because I was out and everything was working fine. And 10 o'clock to about 11:30, a couple of weeks back in December.
Interesting. I wonder what happened. I wonder if your routes came around the internet and then he accepted them as best path for something and that somehow screwed up his routing or something like that.
It didn't make any sense to me. I was like, when he explained it, I was like, okay, if that's what you think is the problem. But
I thought Fujitsu's were like optical muxes. I didn't even think they were like... they must run... maybe they make routers. I don't know.
They've got some Fujitsu, and I'm trying to remember what the other company is that they're going to. Convair something? I can't recall it. I don't actually run the equipment. But
interesting.
Hopefully
that was in a window for him.
No, middle of the day.
Oh, that's terrible. Yeah, I thought you were talking about at night. No, that was the middle of the day, huh?
No, I was like, dude, if turning on a BGP session to me at least seemed like it should just work.
No, yeah,
unless,
for sure.
Yeah. And he was the guy who suggested a window, but he said, nope, we're going at this time because this is the time when I would like to do this.
Yeah, we turn up customer peers during the middle of the day as well. No big deal.
He was super awesome and he figured out what he did wrong, and the beautiful thing is like I came to him being like, hey, these other guys are having issues and there's some weird stuff that I'm seeing. I'm working fine, but he was like, yeah, he didn't like turn and like throw me under the bus right off the bat, which was super nice.
That's good.
You know, poor bastard. All that stuff.
We've all been there.
Oh yeah.
We've all taken out Colorado once or twice.
Yeah. Well, see, I think he's like, they do Sprint. Most of Sprint's stuff, they feed off of our fibers
That's cool.
Area. So, or at least a couple of their towers. It's really nice because they not only do we feed them fiber, but they also take a rack spot for $200 a month, 1U, just because they have a we spit out single mode to them, and they want to go multi mode from one thing to another and then single mode back out, and it's just like, why? More moving parts, but yeah, whatever. They like to do that. Sprint.
Yeah. A lot of those telcos, they standardize. So no matter where they go, this is the same thing we put everywhere. all of our field techs have spares for all the same thing. They're all trained on this exact model, so it's probably one of those things.
Yeah, it makes sense.
We have some telcos in our data center where we have redundant generators going to redundant power rooms, handing them diverse power feeds inside the building. And so they're getting two AB power feeds, and they still have like six batteries and inverters inside there. You know, you're going from two separate sets of UPSs into your UPS into your cabinet. So, seems more likely that would require them to trust you.
Well, yeah, it requires them to trust you. Yeah.
But it's the idea that they put the exact same thing everywhere they go, no matter where they are. So I get it, right? It's safety and familiarity sort of thing.
Oh, yeah. Tons
safety
of it.
Safety and what you know. So speaking of carriers, we were doing last mile for a carrier just recently, and they wanted us to do a test, to give them a report, like a test report over some transport stuff. And nobody's ever asked us to do that before. So we had to do an RFC 2544 test, and I'm looking at the report right here, and it's basically a test that has a bunch of different frame sizes that run at different rates. So they wanted us to do like 40-second, 60-second at different maximum throughput rates, and then it would measure loss percentages and latency, jitter, stuff like that across it. Nobody had ever asked us to do that. We ended up finding an Agilent Dell Framescope Pro on eBay for like $300. And we used an ME3400 E-Series switch to do an Ethernet loopback. So what it does is the little test device plugs in on one side of the network, goes through the transport, hits the ME3400, and the Ethernet loopback configuration takes all the packets in, and it flip-flops the MAC address, you know, the send in the source and destination MAC address, and then fires it back out the same port. So then it just goes back to the tester. So it wasn't that huge a deal. At first, we were going through a 2011, and it failed. Not miserably, but it failed on a lot of different tests. Then we swapped that out for just a little Cisco 3560C. It's like this 8-port guy with like passive cooling. Put that in there and it passed perfectly. So I'm not sure exactly what the MikroTik was doing that it didn't like, but it was failing a bunch of those tests, like the throughput test. It was getting like some kind of like packet loss or whatever, apparently, on whatever. And it was low bandwidth tests. There were like 10 meg tests, and all this stuff was connected via fiber. So I'm not 100% sure what was going on there, but it is what it is. Anybody's ever asked you guys to produce a report for them? Like, hey, I need a specific report of some sort.
I've been, since I set up their network monitoring, I've been making bandwidth reports and stuff like that for various customers, business customers. Especially like when they're saying, hey, we're having issues with the internet. I'm like, well, because you're using all of your 50 megabits per second for the last 3 days in upload, so you can't get anything. So that's the nice thing. But I actually, on Mimosa forums, there was somebody last year in October talking about having to do 2544s, and he had to do it for each wireless link that he was setting up for this company, and see if he was wondering if there might be some other way of getting around. I was like, no, they really want that. So it seemed like a lot of effort, but if your thing, it was only like $300, that's pretty slick.
Yeah, the tester was $300. The ME3400E was about $50. So less than $400 all in one time. Mm-hmm. It's not terrible.
Does the tester like give you like a report of like, hey, this is where it was dropping packets, or does it just say pass fail?
It's pass fail. So it shows the section, like this is the test I was performing, and then shows the frame size, all the different ones, and then it shows like transmit rate, megabits per second, frames per second, max rate it reached, max frames, loss percentage, and then at the end it says pass or fail. So you just kind of put in your pass fail parameters and then let this thing go and completes a report. Mm-hmm. I think you can USB cable the tester into like a laptop or something like that if you want to like mass pull all the reports out. But I mean, it's really ugly text file. But it's, I mean, that's all they wanted. That's all they wanted to see. So layer two, testing layer two, peer MAC address, NIT address, go. And it just blasts through.
Huh. That's cool.
You can even do like CVLANs and stuff like that. So you could tell it, you know, my protocol type 8100 standard 802.1Q VLAN, or you could change it to be like service provider VLAN. Blast through. So it's pretty cool. I had just never been asked to do one, so it was a pretty good bit of scrambling to figure out what we were going to do. Turns out it wasn't too bad. Now, looking at all new equipment to do that, oh man, everything was like a few $1,000 a piece. So I was pretty excited to see this guy on here. Seems as though this is probably going to be the one and only time anybody ever asks us to produce a report. But I was thinking, if we ever have problems in the future where everything really does look clean, you know, maybe we could just throw this out there and, you know, put somebody at ease to say, hey, look, man, we even ran this telco test and everything's coming up clean. Or potentially like, give us a minute, we'll take a look at it, sort of thing. Just in case it really is us.
Yeah. It seems like a really like cool like value added thing that you can be like, hey, look at this connection that we have, and for whatever extra, we'll make sure it's what about 24, 25, 44,
yeah,
rated or whatever.
I mean, it doesn't seem too crazy, right? Like whenever we have guys come out and do fiber splicing, we always get reports from them.
Yeah,
you know, we've had we'll throw our Fluke meter on our copper connections and make sure that it comes up clean and test there. So, you know, it would be a horrible idea to do it. Although, you know, a lot of Metro Ethernet kit, if you buy the better stuff like the Sienna or the new Metro Cisco stuff or Juniper stuff, has this functionality built in, and you can just, you know, have it do a test across without having to use special equipment. So that's an option as well. We just didn't
have any other place for this. Yeah, but do you want to trust that, or do you want to have a third party thing make your life all better?
I don't know, man. If it's built into the kit, I don't have to get off my butt. I can just do it from the command line.
Yeah.
So I don't have to go anywhere. I think I'd rather go that route. I don't want to truck roll somebody out there. And also, you know, if you're doing it with a physical piece of kit, I've got to unhook somebody's connection. Whereas, you know, this, I could just say, hey, there's going to be a 30-second window. And then fire it off and give them a report.
Yeah. That's what I use MicroTik's bandwidth test for all the time, is...
Yeah, be like, sure.
I don't have to worry about this. So,
let's see. Next on the list, I wanted to get a shout out to Nick Braulio. He was on Packet Pushers. Yeah, he's super famous. I get it. I'm not envious. I think he's a great guy, and good for him. He can go to hell. No, he's a great guy. He was on Packet Pushers. Check it out. It was the real life segment routing. It was actually pretty cool to listen to. You hear him talk about a lot of their controller-based networking, so it's pretty neat to hear a little bit. He gets waist deep, right? He doesn't get all the way underwater, but he gets pretty deep in there, so it's interesting enough to listen to, so give it a check out. So you were talking about, Tommy, all the power talk we've been doing lately. There's been a lot going on in there.
Oh, gosh.
One of the interesting pieces I saw is people were talking about their DC plants and where they actually do fuses and stuff like that. And most people said that they prefer breakers on the input and the output, the major input, going to the batteries, right? That way they can actually isolate parts of that if they need to. But also a breaker is nice as opposed to a fuse, because you can just reset a breaker. Whereas a fuse, you have to replace it. Either one, you got to be there, right? You got to actually go to the site to do the thing.
Yeah, they don't make Wi-Fi connected circuit breakers yet.
Well, I mean, you could rig something up with a servo and a Arduino, I guess, probably. I could see Thomas doing some crazy stuff like that. But there was also some discussion about, do you individually fuse all of your devices? And most people said no, but Ryan McAfee said, hey, I actually use these Blue Sea fuse boxes. And Blue Sea, I'm wondering if they're like marine grade fuse blocks or whatever, but they have screw terminals, so they have an input, or rather they have a positive side, a negative side, and then they have screw terminals on them, but they also have like automotive fuses that you just pop in so you can easily fuse individual devices. And I thought that's a really good compromise. It's really inexpensive. They're like $30 for the block. And I mean, how much is just a handful of automotive fuses? You get those probably off Amazon for $5 or something. So it's really easy to keep a bunch of those around.
Yeah, not only can you keep them in the cabinet and life's glorious, but FYI, all of your techs are going to have a bunch of automotive fuses every time they drive anywhere.
Yeah, I guess so.
And most of them aren't going to be need to use a 5-amp. Like, you can unplug a 5-amp. I've driven many a vehicle that's missing half its fuses.
So you're telling them, take the 5-amp fuse out of your vehicle and put it in the thing, and then just put a piece of wire in your vehicle. Just make a little jumper wire around the fuse.
You don't need the radio.
You'll be fine.
You don't need windshield wipers. You can get back to the office.
Depends on how new their vehicles are, man. Sometimes, like, the radio makes the whole car work somehow or another, it seems like.
Yeah. No, actually, I really liked the circuit breaker auto fuse looking things. The trouble is that all of my stuff now is 48 volt. So, and none of those auto fuses are above 24, at least that I was able to see on Amazon. So,
aren't auto fuses really just looking for the amount of current going through them?
Yeah, mostly. And honestly, like, it's going to have a big enough thing that 48 volts isn't going to jump. But are you going to put something that's not rated for what it's doing to power, you know, have 4 car batteries behind it and possibly blow themselves up?
I would say to you, anybody who's ever used Microtik has done stuff that you're not supposed to do with a device. Yes, I would probably be the guy that would do that, for sure.
Yeah, you're not wrong. You're not right. It's not a wrong argument.
While we're talking about power, something else I found interesting is they were talking about Microtik kit. So a lot of the stuff that has single power supplies, you can also use a PoE injector on, like, Ether-1 to power, right? So, like, dual power supply. But something I didn't know is they said that those should be different voltages, right? The wall wart that you use versus the... I'm not sure what the... why you would need that. You guys have any insight? I was just curious why. I mean, it's interesting. I'll remember it now because it's so odd, but I have no idea why you would do that.
So I have two things. On the previous one with fuses, when I used to do the ISP with micropops, in each micropop, what we would do is, so we would have a charge controller that has a built-in fuse, of course, that you plug the batteries and the utility power into. But what we would do is we would have a little controller, basically like an Arduino, that had a relay for every single device connected to that site. And the relay had a built-in fuse. And why we would do it this way, because from the controller we could trip each individual relay up and down if we needed a hard reboot on a device. And so it was a really nice way to have both a fuse per device and a relay per device. Of course, it wasn't a breaker, it was a built-in fuse in the relay, so if it broke, you know, you would have to drive out and switch out the entire relay. But it accomplished both having that and being able to remotely reboot devices if you ever needed to. Which we had all of that integrated into a custom PCB and printed from a local shop, which cost like, I don't know, 15 euro or 20 bucks or something. One of our electrical techs designed the PCB and it was really nice. So as an option, you know, you can, for really super cheap, you can just use relays with built-in fuses. And on top of that, you get the remote reboot thingy, which is super useful. It has saved my ass or you know, many times from a 1 a.m. drive out.
So it wasn't like a digital fuse, was it? So if the fuse went, you'd still have to go and replace it physically, right?
Yeah, definitely. Oh, definitely, sure. Yeah.
All right. Still, that's cool. I think, was it digital loggers? Those, they make like a little relay module too that's like DIN rail mount that's got the screw terminals, so you can kind of do that with a DC plant. I bet you there's a lot of different variants. I think Control by Web does some of those as well.
Yeah.
For us, it was mostly how can we do it for, you know, 20 bucks?
Yeah.
And for 20 bucks, it was super simple.
Yeah, as I said, these things certainly aren't 20 bucks. But like the digital loggers one does the auto ping thing, so you can have it The little controller itself will ping the devices, and if the radio doesn't respond for X amount of
time. Yeah, we had that set up as well.
Of course you did, Thomas. I get it. You're better than us.
One other really nice trick which I can recommend to people, which has also saved my ass many times, is just place a little HAP or a map inside of the box. And what we did is it was always using NetWatch. It was checking for upstream connection back to the core. And if that connection dropped, it started broadcasting an emergency 2.5G management SSID. So when we had a breakdown at like 2 a.m. in the morning, and since we were doing micro pops, you know, these pops would be on top of people's houses and stuff like that, and you don't want to wake up those people at 2 a.m. So I would just drive down under somebody's house, you know, I would connect to the emergency SSID, which was already broadcasting, and it was inside of the management subnet and connected at L2 to everything. So I could basically just drive to a house, not have to wake up the people, or, you know, wouldn't even care if they weren't home, and I would fix the micro pop from there, just sitting inside of the heated car under the house. And then one time, actually, they caught me, and they were like, what are you doing here under our house? I'm just fixing the stuff on your roof. I didn't want to wake you up. And, yeah.
Well, I was here. I thought I'd snap a couple of photos through your window. And
so it's like you can do super nice things for super cheap with micro pops, or with, you know, management and, mm-hmm. and remote powering and remote reboots on you know, your boxes.
You break my nowadays, brain, Thomas.
Well, nowadays we have USB drives that you plug in that have SIM card built in, and then you have your
Course, there's always, you can always have, you know, out of band management, and it's definitely encouraged to have that, but you know, if you have micro pops and you have mm-hmm. 30 of them around the city, you know, that adds up, right? And so yeah, definitely.
Cool. What was your second thought on powering MikroTik with PoE and then the regular, the difference in voltage?
Yeah, so actually how that works is, funny thing about redundant power, it's never 100% redundant. Even if you look on your servers with redundant PSUs, you know, like your HP older servers, you will find out that it's always one PSU doing the work. The load across CPUs will never, or PSUs will never be split like 50-50. It will be one PSU pulling 500 watts and the other pulling maybe 20, which is just a dummy load, really. So how that works is actually anytime you are powering two devices, you could say redundantly, from two electrical sources, only one will be active. And if both of them were active at the same time, they would have to be completely 100% synchronized. The phase would have to be in sync, which is pretty much impossible. So how that works, and I am sure somebody who's better at electrical will come in and correct me and you know, tell me I'm doing this all wrong. I'm not the electrical guy. I just know this from other electrical guys that were doing the electrical for us. But basically, you have to have a voltage difference, and you only pull from one voltage. You cannot merge two electrical lines, because you will screw up phase sync and other timing things, and basically the wave, the electrical wave, just electricity doesn't work that way. So that is why you have to have two different voltages, and there will be a regulator or a actual, you know, part that will select which voltage is getting pulled from, which will then get downscaled, and, you know, there's the pull-ups and pull-downs and stuff like that adjust it to the internal voltages that the devices need. But before all that electrical circuitry, there will be basically a selector circuit which chooses which power line is being utilized. So that is why you have to have two different voltages, so it will usually pick either the lower or the higher voltage, but the point is just to not to have a sufficient separation between power inputs to be able to select which one the actual power is being utilized from.
Booyah.
And I am sorry for anybody that is actually electrically electrically inclined and for all the mistakes that I made there. Yeah. But that's the basic concept.
That's what you're cooking. Yeah. All right, so I got a jet in a few minutes, but we have a lot of stuff on here, so let me pick out a couple. Unimus 2.0.0 Beta 1 next week. Tell us about that.
Oh man, it was crazy. The last 2 weeks were completely crazy, but finally we made it happen. 2-0 is going out next week. It's about 70% of the code was completely rewritten in Unimas. Wow. There is a huge changelog. The changelog is about 120 lines. There is many new features. There's tons of improvements. There's tons of bug fixes. And yeah, it was serious development crunch to get it working, but finally.
Gotcha. So when would you recommend we upgrade? Should we wait for the beta 2?
I would really like for people to help us testing this. This is as I said, a major rewrite. So if you can help us test this, please help us test, but don't deploy it to production unless it's the actual 2.0.0 stable release, which we're hoping should be out in about middle of February. So production not until 2.0.0 stable, but please help us test this.
That's no fun.
The only way I test is in production, jeez.
That's right. I only have one network, bud. No, that's why you have friends with other networks. They're for testing. Yeah. Hey, let me try this thing. See how it does. All right. Let's see. Pick one more topic and talk about it, Thomas. What do you like in there?
The SpaceX Starlink style—I completely love it.
All right, tell us.
So there is a YouTube channel that heavily covers how Starlink constellation will work and does some amazing visualization and simulation on the Starlink constellation. I'm sure we'll provide a link. And there was a video recently. So first of all, there were a bunch of videos about half a year ago that explained how latency over Starlink will be much better than any possible land-based direct fiber connections can be. And but that simulation or that explanation video assumed a completed Starlink constellation, which is over 12,000 satellites planned.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, won't happen for years, right? But since Starlink will actually be, or SpaceX said they are planning to start offering services in mainland US by the end of 2020, the constellation won't yet be finished. So there was another very interesting video on the channel which explained how Starlink will utilize ground stations and basically how Starlink will work until the constellation is finished, and how even utilizing ground stations for relays and hops, Starlink will still, even in its infancy, will still provide better latency than any possible land-based direct fiber connection, which is super interesting. And it's not some random made up crap.
Are they? So let me pose a question to you. Is that in just distance wise? So if you were going to go, well, let's make it a big jump. Let's say a 1,000 miles. If you're doing it in fiber versus using Starlink, they're saying the latency would be lower in Starlink. Or are they claiming that the normal services you're accustomed to using while I'm playing Call of Duty online, I'll have less latency getting to the server than I would if I had fiber connection at the home? Which one are we talking about?
So, directly from the video, it was LA to New York connection.
Okay.
So it wasn't a small scale, you know, 1,000 miles. It was across the US, you know, a continental US connection. So using Starlink, even with ground relay stations, with ground hops, is faster than having a direct fiber optic cable from LA to New York.
Gotcha.
And yeah, it's latency. And so, of course, even, you know, reality is that you will never have a direct fiber optic cable, land-based fiber optic cable between LA and New York. There will be a bunch of, you know, routing and stuff will go around various places. Mm-hmm. And there is, you know, latency added in processing and in routing and all of that.
Yeah, so regeneration.
Reality is that Starlink will be quite a bit faster latency-wise.
As long as their processing doesn't take forever.
Yeah, of course. There's, you know, this was all in perfect circumstances, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right?
But I get it. But so, that's interesting. Well, I mean, something that kind of broke my brain a while ago, and this actually came from Mike Hammett, believe it or not. But he was talking about how some trading companies use wireless links primarily and then fiber backup. And what I'd never thought about is that light will travel faster in free space than it will through a strand of glass. And it makes sense when you look at it from kind of a physics perspective, right?
Yeah, I think in a piece of glass, the light speed is 60% of free space light speed, and don't quote me on that number either.
Right.
But it's a quite a sizable difference, and also you know starting much of the travel time of the packet will be in vacuum as opposed to even in atmosphere, right? So there is even higher speed there.
Gotcha, but that sounds interesting. They're not going to, I mean, Starlink's not going to be selling point to points to people. Well, I mean, they might, right? Are they talking about doing point to point transport?
I hope so.
Likely. What will happen is that the majority of income for Starlink in the early phases will come from, you know, high frequency trading.
Yeah.
So they will definitely be selling to those guys because there is major money in there and they can offer much lower latencies than any other competition. Mm-hmm. And there is, of course, very little public information available so far on what Starlink will or will not offer. Of course, they are saying they will be going directly after end customers, but people are speculating it might actually be really worth it as well to sell high throughput links to entities that will want to buy high throughput links from Starlink as well. So it's all speculation for
right
now.
Yeah, right. I mean, if they like, for me in my situation, I would love to be able to get new transport provider to any data center anywhere. Like, I'm stuck right now with two providers or CenturyLink. And CenturyLink has expressed multiple times that they don't want to mess with me unless I'm spending $15,000 a month. It's like, well, I'm not going to spend that much for a gigabit of transport.
Sounds like you got the wrong reps, bud.
Probably, but I mean, that's why we ended up running our own fiber to Denver as a group of telcos. So, you know, then we don't have to deal with CenturyLink, but it'd be nice to have another upstream provider.
Man, it sure as hell is nice not to have to do fiber locates and repairs. Or know that much.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I can say about using the carriers. It's really nice not to have to dig holes in the ground in the middle of the night.
Well, such is life. But
it is indeed.
You know, I'm sure there's plenty of rural ISP guys that would love to get transport somewhere and then do distribution, which probably could be a great way for, you know, as long as Starlink will let you resell. Yeah. Elon, please let us resell your stuff.
Right? He's going to have somebody to go to the trailer house and put the radio up on there, you know? So why not just utilize guys in the field that are accustomed to doing that sort of thing?
Yeah, and then he gets better latency for everything because there's fewer direct things talking to a satellite.
Yeah, for sure.
I think it would be, it just makes sense for them to sell bulk or transit connectivity, right?
Mm-hmm.
But who knows?
All right. Well, let's stick a fork in it. Thank you guys so much. Thomas Kiernek, if people are going to find you out on the World Wide Web, how would they do that?
Yeah, as always, just Google for me. I'm easy to find, all the social networks, everything else. And of course, always, unimus.net. There is a live chat there. People have actually been using that, so wow. So yeah, just press the live chat button, ask for me, and I'll be there.
Have you gotten anybody to say, hey, I heard you on the podcast, just want to say hello, bye?
No, I haven't had that yet.
Serious inquiries only, people. That's what I'm hearing right now.
And now we are going to get spammed with just saying hi.
I sure hope so. Tommy, if people wanted to get a hold of you out on the internet, how would they do that?
tkrogan@rtebb.net if you want to email me for whatever reason. I'm on the Mimosa forums all the time, and I help people with Mimosa problems. And then the Brothers with Slack, I'm there all the time too. And so those are probably the best ways to reach me.
Excellent. If you want to get a hold of me, I'm greg@gregsoul.com. You can go to gregsoul.com and find me there. You can also really easily find me if you go to patreon.com/thebrotherswisp and you jump in the Slack. I am there. I'm actually pretty responsive, especially when you at me or slide me a DM. I'm really good about seeing that stuff. A lot of this stuff, you guys are getting into conversations where, man, I just don't have any intelligence, and there's 20 people talking with confidence about these subjects, and it's like, that is so amazing to me, how much knowledge you guys have as a collective. I think if we could all just mind meld, we'd take over the world pretty quickly. Obviously, Thomas has already put together the master plan. We would just be enacting said plan, so no big deal there. But thank you guys for coming on the podcast tonight, sacrificing some of your Saturday. Or is it Sunday for you, Thomas, I guess, probably. Questions, comments, keep them coming. Thanks, everybody.
Sit back and start learning.
Bye.
Lighting up the towers so people can start searching. Shooting up the web in neighborhoods, net surfing. We got horrible jokes, we're loud and annoying. But we're informative facts, we're not disappointing. Just give us a listen, because fun is the mission. I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.